Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Surgical Care Improvement Project Heart Failure Initiative conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star then zero. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Denise Faulkner-Cameron. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Livia, and good morning, all, and thank you for joining us, and welcome to our second conference call for the Surgical Care Improvement Project Heart Failure Initiative. This is in addition to the monthly webinars we've been having as part of our VTE study with the ARC agency, which has been featuring Dr. Gregory Maynard. Today's call, we're going to be focusing on the heart failure component of the initiative. Before we begin this morning, I would like to give everyone an opportunity, if you have not yet done so, to access the materials for today's conference call. And you can do that by logging on to our JENI website, which is our community online forum, which is at jeny.ipro.org. Once you are on the JENI main site, scroll down to the discussion topics forum and click on IPRO QIO initiatives for the ninth scope of work. And then there is a link entitled Skip Heart Failure. And when you click on that, it'll bring you to the Skip Heart Failure forum. And simply click on the link entitled Skip Heart Failure Conference Call Materials for March 11, 2009. For this morning's call, we are going to review the Skip Heart Failure quarterly reports, and after, we would be featuring one of our mentoring hospitals for the initiative, the St. Francis Heart Center in Roslyn, New York. But before we go into that, we will just have a brief overview of the quarterly reports, which were sent out to each facility last week. So hopefully everyone received them. But for the purpose of this morning's call, I'm going to ask you to refer to the sample report that was included in the handout materials for this morning's call. Now, our purpose for designing these reports is to help hospitals in the initiative track their progress, which is a key performance improvement strategy, as it allows hospitals to identify opportunities for achieving your goals or maintaining your goals if you find that your goals have already been achieved. The data in this report is based on the data that you have been submitting to the CMS Clinical Warehouse for public reporting, and we will be updating these reports and sending them out to you on a quarterly basis throughout the duration of this initiative. So I would like to refer you to, let's start by looking at Table 1, which on Table 1 on the first page, which shows a comparison of your facility's performance, including denominators and numerators, for the 8 skip measures and the 1 heart failure measures for 2 public reporting periods, which are first quarter 2007, which CMS has defined as the baseline period for this initiative, and second quarter 2008, which is the most recent period for which complete validated data are available. So we see in our sample report for the ABC hospital that on the heart failure 3 indicator for baseline period, their score is first quarter 2007 is 86.7 and 100% for the current validated period of second quarter 2008. This table also shows where your facility ranks for each measure among the 30 facilities that are participating in this initiative. There is also a ranking for your overall average score across all measures. Just one caveat that we like to point out regarding the ranking is that you may notice in some instances where your performance on a particular measure did improve from baseline, however, your ranking may not have. For example, notice that while ABC Hospital did improve slightly on the SCIP infection 2 indicator, their ranking slipped slightly from 8 to 10. And while they improved more significantly on the VTE indicator, their ranking maintained the same at 21. Now, this isn't to deflect the fact that hospitals have improved. It's only that other hospitals in the initiative may have improved at a higher rate. So it's just being used as a barometer for you, and to keep in mind that your goal is to improve your performance on each of the rates as well as your overall ranking. Another point of information regarding Table 1 and the other charts contained in the reports that we want to bring to your attention is that data may not be available on some of the measures due to differences in the reporting requirements for the respective quarters, as well as differing criteria for cases being included in the denominator. An example would be the skipped card 2 indicator, which has a criteria of the patient having been on a beta blocker prior to hospital arrival. And also the skipped card 2 indicator isn't required for public reporting until first quarter 2009. So there are some hospitals that may not have been voluntarily submitting the report, or have not been voluntarily submitting data on that indicator prior. And another example, of course, is the skipped infection 4 indicator, which is procedure specific. It's only looking at cardiac surgeries. So at this time, I want to turn your attention to figure 1, which is on page 2. And that figure is entitled Facility Performance Trends. And this figure includes a series of run charts on your performance on the skip and heart failure indicators. Again, we're looking at first quarter 2007 baseline to the current validated period of second quarter 2008. And in addition to showing your improvements or your fluctuation from one period to the next, these run charts also allow you to see how your performance compares to that of the top performing hospitals in the country, and that's by comparing your scores for each of these periods to what's called the National Achievable Benchmark of Care. And this benchmark of care, or this threshold, is based on the weighted average score of the top performing hospitals that care for approximately 10% of the total patients across the nation. There's an appendix in this report on the last page that provides some additional information, including a link to information on how the ABC, or the Achievable Benchmark of Care, is calculated. Now, the last series of graphs that's included in Figure 2 on page 3, which is entitled Facility Performance Among New York State Hospitals, shows how your facility compares against all the facilities in New York State for all of the skip indicators and the heart failure indicators. And this is including the four rolling quarter from third quarter 2007 to second quarter 2008. Each of these graphs displays the performance of all the hospitals in New York State, ranking in ascending order from left to right. Your facility is displayed as a vertical bar against the shaded background of all the facilities in the state. And then the shaded areas is divided into two sections. The pink shaded area shows the hospitals with measures that are below the national ABC, while the blue area represents those hospitals whose rates are above the ABC. And you could use these graphs to determine your hospital's relative performance by seeing how far to the left, you are, which is a poorer performance, or how far to the right you are, which would indicate a better performance. What we hope each hospital to see over time as the periods evolve is a shift from the pink areas to the bluer areas. And finally, the table on the appendix on the last page provides a description of all the performance measures and a link, as I mentioned earlier, for additional information on the Achievable Benchmark of Care. I would just ask, if you have not yet done so, to please share these reports with your team and senior leadership. We will also be asking you to share your comments and feedback on them with us. And finally, I just want to mention that we will be taking questions that you may have regarding the reports later on during the Q&A session for this call. So at this time, I would just like to go into the main portion of today's call, which is going to be focusing on the heart failure 3 indicator. And we are pleased to have with us the team and their clinical champion, Dr. Alan Goldman from the St. Francis Hospital, which is a 360-bed facility and designated heart center located in Roslyn, New York, which is down here in Long Island. St. Francis has been an active participant with IPRO during past initiatives, including the SCIP project that we had as part of our previous AIDS scope of work and the appropriate care measures project, which looked at two of the cardiac clinical topics of heart failure and AMI. And they had realized some monumental improvements as a result with working on those two initiatives with us. And we are very grateful that they have graciously agreed to be a mentoring hospital for this initiative and join us today for today's call. So first, we're going to hear from their clinical champion, Dr. Alan Goldman. And before I turn the call over to Dr. Goldman, I just want to give you a little background on him. Dr. Goldman received his medical degree from St. George's University School of Medicine, and he continued his training in internal medicine and interventional cardiology at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. He is board certified in internal medicine and cardiovascular disease. He is also the author of several research studies, one of which he presented during an assembly for the American College of Chest Physicians. And Dr. Goldman's affiliations include the American Medical Association, the American College of Cardiology, and the Nassau County Medical Society. So at this time, I'm going to turn the call over to the St. Francis Hospital, and we'll begin with hearing from Dr. Alan Goldman.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having us. I'm going to talk a little bit about heart failure and why all of this data is important and why we need to really work on having our patients on the ACEs and ARBs. Heart failure is a significant public health problem here in the United States and really worldwide. In the U.S., about 5 million people are affected in this country, and about 500,000 new patients are diagnosed each year with heart failure. It's quite prevalent in the elderly, and with prolongation of life and the rapid aging of the U.S. population, the incidence of heart failure is growing each year. Right about now, it affects about 10 in every 1,000 people who are over the age of 65. Hospital discharges for heart failure increased by 157% between the years 1979 and 2002, and heart failure accounts for about 15 million office visits per year and 6.5 million hospital days each year. Mortality from heart failure, unfortunately, does remain high, and certainly the costs of caring for these patients remains very high. Heart failure was the most common Medicare DRG back in 2005 when the ACC and AHA guidelines were written, and more Medicare dollars were spent for diagnosing and treating heart failure than for any other DRG at that time. Now, regarding heart failure, when patients suffer an event that leads to left ventricular systolic dysfunction, they have a concomitant drop in their cardiac output. What this does is lead to an increased sympathetic activity and an increase in the renin-angiotensin and aldosterone system. What this causes is an increase in sodium and water retention in the body, as well as increased vasoconstriction in the periphery. This leads to further congestion in the lungs and the pulmonary system. This increased congestion in the chest and thorax now impedes emptying of the left ventricle, and this further leads to deterioration of heart function. And you can see this is basically a vicious cycle that will keep on repeating and repeating and causing worsening and worsening LV function and heart failure symptoms as the heart just continues to fail. So the treatment of LV dysfunction and heart failure really requires that we try and block this cycle in as many points as possible. Now, the two agents we're discussing today, ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers, are two vitally important agents in the treatment of heart failure. Both of these agents inhibit the renin-angiotensin and aldosterone system in different ways. The ACE inhibitors block the enzyme that's responsible for converting the angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2, whereas the angiotensin receptor blockers block the effect of angiotensin 2 on the AT1 receptor in the body. Now, what angiotensin II does is increase oxygen demand. It increases coronary and renal vasoconstriction. It increases preload and afterload for the heart, and it predisposes to left ventricular hypertrophy. It increases the catecholamine release in the body as well as aldosterone release, and all of this in turn will cause sodium and water retention and worsening heart failure symptoms. Clearly, this is not what we want to do for our heart failure patients. Now, in an effort to improve healthcare quality, clinical practice guidelines have been developed for various disease states, and these guidelines attempt to suggest diagnostic and therapeutic strategies for patients that would tend to be valid in most circumstances for most patients. And they're developed using available scientific evidence and have varying degrees of confidence depending on the quality and the quantity of the available data and evidence. Now, in 2005, the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association published the Heart Failure Clinical Performance Measures in the Journal of Circulation. And what they did was list as a Class 1 recommendation the use of ACE inhibitors or angiotensin receptor blockers in patients with heart failure and left ventricular systolic dysfunction. And what a Class 1 indication means is that the benefits of therapy far outweigh any risk of that therapy. Now, this recommendation came along with a level A of certainty, meaning that it had the highest level of evidence to support this recommendation. And the way they got this evidence really came from three landmark trials that led to the recommendation. Back in 1987, the New England Journal published the Consensus Trial, which was a Scandinavian trial that looked at the ACE inhibitor enalapril in patients who had severe heart failure. They looked at New York Heart Association Class 4 heart failure patients, which is the most severe class of heart failure symptoms at rest. And these patients were randomized in a double-blinded fashion to either receiving a placebo or enalapril in doses of 2.5 to 20 milligrams a day, in addition to their conventional heart failure treatment at that time. And the primary endpoint at 6 months was looking at mortality, and what they found was in the enalapril-treated group, there was a 40% reduction in mortality compared with the group treated with placebo. At 1 year, that reduction was 31%, and by the end of the study, it was 27%, and at all times, this was highly statistically significant. Now, after 20 months, the ethical review committee in this trial looked at all the data in a preliminary fashion and found the results to be so compelling and not explainable by chance alone that they felt enrollment had to be terminated because it would be unethical to withhold ACE inhibitors to this population of patients. Now, interestingly, when they did this trial, the diagnosis of CHF was based mainly on clinical criteria, and measurements of ejection fraction were not done routinely and were not required for entry into the trial. In 1991, the New England Journal published the SOLVED trial, and this was a multi-centered U.S.-based trial looking at the use of enalapril in patients with chronic heart failure and ejection fractions of less than 35%. They continued conventional treatment, and patients were randomized again to either enalapril or placebo. This trial looked at heart failure patients of a more moderate nature rather than the more acute and sicker populations evaluated in the consensus trial. About 90% of the patients in the SOLVE trial had class 2 or 3 heart failure, meaning that their heart failure was either occurring with mild exertion or with more moderate exertion, but really not at rest. They were a better controlled population and probably more representative of what we see in a daily practice, other than maybe a more specialized heart failure center. Now, once again, in the SOLVE trial, the benefit of enalapril was borne out with a clear reduction in mortality and hospitalizations for heart failure in the enalapril-treated group versus the placebo group. Following that, in 2003, the New England Journal published the Valiant trial, which was a multinational, multi-center trial that evaluated the use of an angiotensin receptor blocker, specifically valsartan, in comparison with the ACE inhibitor captopril. And this trial was done in patients who had prior myocardial infarction complicated by left ventricular systolic dysfunction or congestive heart failure. And patients with acute myocardial infarction were treated with standard medical therapy, and within about 10 days, they were randomized to one of three arms in, once again, a double-blinded fashion. There was a monotherapy arm with valsartan and a monotherapy arm with captopril, and the third arm of this trial looked at the combination of captopril and valsartan. And the primary endpoint of this trial was, again, all-cause mortality. Ejection fractions to enter into the trial had to be less than 35% to 40%, depending on how it was measured, and about 15,000 patients were enrolled. So this was a fairly large study, and once again occurred in multiple countries and multiple centers. And what this study concluded was that valsartan was as effective as captopril in patients who were at high risk of cardiovascular events following myocardial infarction. Captopril, once again, was shown to be of benefit as well. And interestingly, the combination of the ACE inhibitor and the ARB was shown to increase the risk of adverse events without actually improving survival. Now, the findings from these trials led to the ACC-AHA statement that ACE inhibitors have been shown to decrease morbidity and mortality as well as hospitalizations for patients with heart failure and left ventricular systolic dysfunction. The efficacy of ARBs in this population has been well supported also. And the conclusion is that ACE inhibitors or ARBs are recommended for all patients with left ventricular systolic dysfunction and current or prior symptoms of heart failure unless a specific contraindication exists. Now, the common reasons not to consider the use of these drugs or to discontinue the use of the drugs, most of us are familiar with the ACE inhibitor cough, and this occurs in varying degrees, probably about 5 to 20%, and tends to be more common in women, interestingly. But that would be a reason certainly to switch a patient off an ACE inhibitor and try the angiotensin receptor blocker, which has a much lower clinical incidence of coughing. Both agents can cause hyperkalemia or high potassium in about 5% of patients. To a lesser extent, both will cause worsening renal insufficiency, unacceptable hypotension and low blood pressure, as well as allergic reactions, including rash or angioedema. They're also contraindicated in pregnancy, specifically the second or third trimester of pregnancy, but we tend to try and avoid these drugs in women of childbearing age, or certainly anyone who is pregnant or attempting to get pregnant due to the potential for birth defects. In summary, I think you can see there is clear and concise evidence that patients with heart failure and with left ventricular systolic dysfunction have a clear mortality benefit, as well as a reduction in heart failure symptoms, an improved sense of well-being, improved exercise tolerance, less hospitalizations when they are treated with ACE inhibitors or ARBs. And every effort really should be made to initiate and continue long-term treatment with these agents unless a real and true contraindication exists. Thank you.
Denise? Hello? Denise? Denise? This is Maureen Goss, and I'll continue with the rest of the presentation. Just to give you a little bit more of the background of St. Francis. St. Francis was founded in 1922 by the Franciscan Missionaries of Mary for Children with Rheumatic Heart Disease. We're a member of the Catholic Health Services of Long Island and carry out the healing ministry of the Church and the Diocese of Rockville Center. Our mission is built upon our heritage, always emphasizing respect for the dignity of individuals and compassionate treatment for all. The spirit of people who work at St. Francis is very special. We're fortunate to have a close group of caregivers, many who have lifetime careers here. The caregivers are vested to seeing St. Francis succeed in providing excellent patient care. Keeping our patients as the most important focus and doing right by the patient is always number one. St. Francis is a magnet-recognized facility known for patient care excellence and ranked as one of the best places to work. We have one of the leading cardiac care programs in the nation, and we also offer other expanding programs in vascular, prostate, ENT, orthopedic, and general surgery. So we're not just the heart center anymore. We have a comprehensive program in community health and education at the Donatus Center. Over the past year, we've had a great expansion and with a new building called the Donatus Pavilion, and expanding clinical space by 40%. With expansion of cardiac cath labs, ORs, critical care beds, and the emergency room. We have a non-teaching structure where the nursing communicates directly with the attending and mid-level practitioners assist the attending. We do have students in other technologies such as nursing and technologists. If you look at slide number 5, I have a list of Deming's 14 points attached to this presentation because Deming's points are consistent with what we do for core measures. A shift from the outside inspection group to just looking at OFIs, opportunities for improvement, is important. You want to start looking at what happens at the beginning of a process and weaving improvements throughout your daily actions. We also want to drive out fear and help people do better jobs. We don't want people to be afraid to talk about what is going on and what they're doing. You learn most from those that do the job. Improvement is continuous, and we're going to focus on contraindications, which I'll talk about in a little bit. The key to success, slide 6, key to success is leadership buy-in. Leaders promoting core measures within the hospital helps the people pay attention. For example, our department noticed that we needed more staff to complete our increasing core measure abstraction, follow-up, and data integrity checks. That was received because the role is valued by leadership. We also requested physician champions and received an instant volunteer from Dr. Alan Goldman for both the AMI and CHF core measures. We have also physician leaderships with SCIP and pneumonia core measures. We have a monthly section in the medical newsletter, and we're invited to speak at mandatory physician meetings, physician orientations, smaller departmental meetings such as the cath lab. We report to support services, hospital PI, departmental meetings, and we're starting to report to the medical PI committees within our own department so that core measure concepts and outcomes are woven throughout our work in the hospital. Everyone's role is important. We use a multidisciplinary approach to brainstorm and decision-making. The Performance Improvement Department manages core measures at St. Francis. We have our physician leader, and we have our PIRNs who are with us today, who meet as needed weekly and monthly. Slide 7. Communication is very important. We need to increase awareness of the indicators throughout the hospital. Who does what? Who assesses, documents, helps with forms? We need to word our messages differently to different groups. What do you need them to specifically focus on? We need to reach and provide faster feedback to all those involved with an OFI, an opportunity for improvement. And we mostly use emails. It's much faster. We need to build trust within the staff who have various concepts of core measures and the changing healthcare environment. Caregivers are adjusting to the idea of the government grading their care based on documentation. Care is done, the patient does well, but if it's not documented and not documented with specific words, then they don't get the credit. We are finding significant increase in understanding with our practitioners and understanding that best practices is behind the purpose of core measures. We have well-respected physician leaders and staff, which helps the caregivers trust of what we are trying to do. We also need to understand the workload of the staff. The last thing they want to hear about is documentation. So respect for timing is very important. But the best ideas come from those within the system. Think positive, have non-punitive, don't blame, which is Deming's point again. People will be more receptive and offer explanations and ways to improve. Slide 8, some fluctuation in compliance is normal, and you'll see that in the graphs that are attached to the presentation. Check for the trend and the outliers. Don't give up on actions because of a dip. What else is affecting what you're doing? How can you adjust the actions, increase education? Maybe the actions are not in place as you think they are, which is happening with one of our indicators now. Change is not immediate all the time. We need to break habits, reach all the players, reinforce, and build change into the system. We maintain a focus on data integrity. Our staff attends educational WebExes by our vendor Midas, which provides us with excellent support and educational opportunities. Part of our PI plan is to assure double-checking of our OFI charts. We check with another PI nurse and either a physician leader or mid-level practitioner. We have in-office meetings with our own core measure abstractors to document, standardize, and improve our abstraction, follow-up, and education. We need to document all of our actions for improvement. We focus on education to ourselves and the team members. We are reaching out further to physicians and nursing and are going to start core measure education and hospital CE days and orientations. Our process for core measures at St. Francis, the PI department is responsible. We have a vendor, Midas, that provides us with support and education and picks our sample. We do sample for core measures. We don't review 100% of charts. It's a retrospective review of the sample. We enter data directly into the Midas system, check the OFIs after the charts are entered, and talk about how we can make improvements using Plan Do Study Act. PDSA. We also have a targeted concurrent review only for the indicators that we can affect, such as LV assessment. Slide 10 and the two attached graphs talk about our compliance with the LV assessment and the ACE-R of indicators. The link with LV assessment is very important to increase compliance with ACE-R of indicators. Our PI nurses email do targeted concurrent reviews and email the medical PA coordinator daily with list of CHF and AMI patients that are missing LV assessment or who have LVSD that they've identified during this concurrent review. The medical MLP coordinator then follows through with each identified patient, and this has shown great increase in compliance. We also leave orange notices inside the charts that are missing discharge summaries to help cue physicians on what they can document for contraindications. Another issue is a ripple effect of more documentation in the charts. We can identify through the computer patients that have a diagnosis of AMI or CHF on admission, and we can follow up with those patients. But we can identify patients that are through the computer if they're diagnosed after admission. So we need a way to capture these people. When we became aware of that issue, we were already in the process of revising an old core measure documentation form. So we used this process with a multidisciplinary team to improve communication and compliance. The PI department has put into process a computer list of patients with CHF and AMI admitting diagnosis that's automatically printed to each unit. We also have a clinical documentation team that was giving a list of patients with AMI and CHF diagnosis that were made after admission to the head nurse. The nursing unit then places an interdisciplinary plan of care for AMI or CHF, and the nickname for that is an IPOC, and a core measure documentation form, which is part of your attachments, on the chart. The head nurse uses the list and these forms during rounds and coordinates with the unit's pharmacists and mid-level practitioners to help them document any contraindications. So we do have an issue right now with tracking to make sure that these forms are on the chart. We find that some of them are not at this point, so we are tracking all the AMI and CHF charts. We need the diagnosis to communicate, to put these forms on the chart so we can follow through. Another issue is the actual core measure documentation form itself. Where is the form kept? Who puts it on the chart? Where on the chart do you keep it? Who documents on it? And then what are they specifically addressing? We also found that the form was being assessed during the patient's stay, but it would be even more effective if it was assessed again at discharge, so that's a process we have inputted. The resolutions, we've rearranged the words to be very clear. There's sections for diagnosis and arrival. We've reworded words to be, instead of at arrival, to received. We check the form now during the stay and again at discharge. And now, again, we're tracking all the AMI and CHF sample charts for diagnosis on the IPOC and the presence of the core measure documentation form. Slide 14. We have to emphasize documenting contraindications. It's not about a lack of appropriate care, but documenting the thought process behind the excellent care that patients are receiving. We need to educate and try to build in as much of the contraindication and reminders as possible throughout the patient's stay. Forms, there's many issues with forms. What is the process? How do you upgrade the forms? We found that putting forms on the internet is much easier to upgrade them, and it's faster. We have meetings, and we have the different planning to follow through with each of these. Issues about reaching the physicians. We need ways to communicate missing items to physicians before they dictate a discharge summary and need to provide specific physician feedback. We have our physician champions. We staple their bright orange notes inside the chart covers before a physician dictates discharge summary. We've done presentations to the cath lab regarding ACE and ARB and medication reconciliation, which were very well received. Presentation at mandatory physician meetings. We have a monthly medical staff newsletter for Core Measure Corner articles. And we are a new part of physician and nursing orientations. We have Core Measure cards to all the staff members of the hospital. Physician leader sends the attendings letters for every OFI. after it's reviewed. We are invited to monthly meetings with the mid-level practitioners to give them updates on what they should be focusing on. We started tracking individual provider poor measure compliance through our MITA system, and we're building backups into the system. No one is perfect. We need a system of checks. Although the primary responsibility is the physicians to document for such items, we are providing them a backup catch. The issue for reaching nursing is just that there's so many nurses. The PIRN routinely discusses nursing-related issues with monthly nursing PI committee. We have a core measure corner for nursing that's distributed through attached to their paychecks. Also, we attend head nurse meetings and brainstorm why certain OFIs occur. We email nursing leaders and meet with them for their insight on whom to contact and or how to address new issues. We've always sent quarterly reports, but now we're going to be sending unit reports per month as soon as a month is closed out, preliminary results that can compare unit compliance on one sheet of paper, and it's a type of a visual control influence. On slide 18, we have a list of different resources. And one of them is a skip blog, which I do recommend. It's a listserv, so you can sign up for emails, be ready for many, many emails, and set up folders in your computer. But you gain insight into the issues that are affecting people across the nation and how they're resolving them. And you also get much advice from Dr. Bradshaw. And that's all. Thank you.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Maureen, for sharing your facilities. Strategies and recipe for success. And again, thank you, Dr. Goldman, for sharing your clinical expertise on this matter. At this time, we're going to open up the lines for any questions regarding the report that we presented earlier in the call or any calls or comments for Dr. Goldman and Maureen Gauss at St. Francis Hospital Center. So, Livia, can you please give our participants instructions on how to submit a question?
Yes, ma'am. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. You may remove yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key at this time.
Okay, if there are no questions.
I'm showing question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. First question comes from Donna Berseski from Richmond Medical Center. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I just have a question about that core measure documentation form. Is that part of your chart?
Yes, it is. It's a permanent part of the medical record.
And do you take your results right off of that sheet?
Yes. That's why we have our signature there and the date and the time and made it a permanent part.
Okay.
Because once you start requiring them to document on two different forms, you start losing them.
Okay, well, that's excellent.
Pharmacists can document too. Physicians, mid-level practitioners, and pharmacists. That was a change in the first quarter 08.
All right. Okay, thank you.
I have one question about the form as well. This is also Richmond University. A question about, supposing there's any variance from this form, how do you assemble that, and do you meet with the physician specifically? I know you said you have a lot of follow-up meetings, but does this form go with the chart, and then does somebody do an aggregate analysis by unit to see what the variance from this form is?
We put the form into play, and we didn't really track the form 100% of every form that was used. What we did is saw the OFIs that occurred, and when our abstractors started seeing that we had OFIs and the form wasn't in the chart, then that brought our attention back to the form again. We better check every single chart now in the sample and see, is the form being used? Where is the breakdown occurring? So it's not a matter of the form being the breakdown, but there's something that might have been a breakdown during the process of getting the form on the chart.
So do you have like a breakdown of what, or do you know what is like your biggest offender from the forms? Like, well, how would I take this back to the physicians to say, I'm not going to say to them it's not on the chart, but I'm going to say you didn't do what?
We don't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not for the physicians to do. What happens is that as soon as the unit knows that the patient has an AMI or a CHF diagnosis, the nurse takes the form and writes AMI or CHF on the interdisciplinary plan of care, takes the core measure documentation form and puts it in the chart. The mid-level practitioner is really the one that's filling out the form the most. Pharmacists can also fill it out. It's And it's, yes, we have two sources of abstraction, which is the chart and the form. So documentation can also be in the chart.
Oh.
Okay, and you can have conflicting documentation in the form. I'm guessing you just take the latest date when you do the abstraction.
Well, once there's a contraindication, that would count.
Yeah.
So we really haven't found any conflict. I don't, we haven't found any conflict with
the
form.
And the guidelines read that you can take a contraindication at any time during the day.
Yeah. How do you get compliance with this form? Because we had a very similar form, and the compliance was not there. So how did you get compliance?
Yeah, it's feedback. We have, again, the mid-level practitioners are very active on the floors and are part of the rounds. The head nurses also follow through. So they know that the form is there and do assess it. We do see that when the form is there, we do see that there are signatures. And that's why at discharge, we're placing it right next to the medication reconciliation form, because that form is always filled out at patient discharge. And then it will be a matter of just reinforcing with the mid-level practitioners, with their coordinators, and they feed it back to each individual PA to fill out the form. So we do a pretty good follow-up within those groupings.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Also email everyone.
All right. Now I can go back to you. You're asking.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Olivia, do we have any other questions in the queue?
Yes, our next question comes from Lulu Ibanez from St. Barnabas Hospital. Your line is open.
Hi, Maureen. I just also have a question regarding your core measure form that's signed by the physicians or mid-level practitioners.
Uh-huh.
I'm wondering how you're addressing the six discharge instructions for heart failure. It's a requirement that the form with the discharge instruction has to be given to the patient, or a copy of it has to be given to the patient in terms of the activity, diet, and all that. How did your facility were able to have compliance on that?
Well, that does also spur off of the same process, is getting that diagnosis communicated to the team, and we are still working on that, and it does seem to be, if it works, a good way of handling. We have the IPOC has the diagnosis, and once that the discharging and mid-level practitioner or physician fills that out, the nurse would enter the diagnosis into Logicare, which is our system for discharge medication that lists all the medications and has a patient's signature.
Oh, and that also includes the rest of the discharge instructions for heart failure?
Yes, that's built in.
If they enter the CHF diagnosis.
Oh.
By diagnosis. If they enter CHF diagnosis,
uh-huh.
Automatically prints out.
Prints out, and that's what do you give to the patient?
Yes.
Okay.
And a copy stays in the chart.
Okay. And what system are you using?
Logicare.
Logicare. Okay. Thank you.
If the diagnosis is there.
Right. I know it's dependent on the amount, the diagnosis that you put in. One of the things I'm looking is, if the patient came from the ED and is short of breath, sometimes it might not be, we kind of think that it's heart failure, but the way it's put in, it may not be heart failure, but I guess we have to include that as well.
Exactly. That's what we find out. So once that diagnosis is made, either in the progress notes or the orders, then there needs to be communication to the team taking care of the patient.
Right. I'm interested in the Logicare because now I see how you're using it. You mentioned something about printing all the diagnosis of core measure, maybe AMI or heart failure, and giving it to the unit nurses or mid-level practitioners to follow up on the charts and on the patients and make sure that the documentations are there. Maybe I'll talk to you later about Logicare. Will that be okay?
That's fine.
Because we're looking also in the same kind of system. Where we could use it to do concurrent review on the unit floors?
No, not Logicare. MIDAS is the computer system. It's the vendor that you can use for concurrent review, but that's only for patients that have the admitting diagnosis.
Oh, I see.
It pulls up by codes.
Right, I see. And so you could pull it concurrently.
Yes, but what we've done is expanded on that. So if you notice that shortness of breath, those type of patients work into a CHF diagnosis. We've pulled larger reports. You can customize your MIDAS reports mm-hmm. and another diagnosis. So is that for your CHF, your shortness of breath? What's the other diagnosis that's on?
All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
You can use those for concurrent.
I see. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key at this time. I'm showing no further questions.
Thank you, Livia, and thank you, Lulu and Donna, for those questions. At this time, if there are no further questions, we can go ahead and wrap up today's call. But before we do that, I just have some updates to bring you. Hello? I just have some updates to bring everyone. I would like to remind everyone of our next webinar, which is part of the VTE ARC study with Dr. Maynard, and that webinar is on March 26th at 11 a.m. More information, including the materials and the registration information, will be forthcoming soon. Also, we are now moving into the next phase of the project, which includes the individual on-site hospital visits, and we've already begun contacting hospitals, and we'll be contacting everyone in the near future to schedule an on-site meeting with IPRO staff. Also, I just want to let everyone know with regards to the skip list serve that Maureen mentioned in her presentation, it is a listserv that is moderated by Dr. Dale Bratzler, who is the clinical leader for both the SKIP and the Heart Failure Initiative. And it is an opportunity for, or it's a venue for hospitals to post questions as well as share tools and other materials and experiences as they relate to this initiative. So I will send out a link with instructions on how to join that listserv for any hospital that is interested. And you can also disengage from it at any time that you see fit. So at this time, before we close, Livia, if we could just give anyone who may have thought of a question in the last few minutes an opportunity to ask a question. Livia?
Yes, ma'am. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the 1 key at this time.
No questions? Okay, that's great. I would just like to finally remind everyone to please take a few moments to complete the evaluation form that was included in today's handouts. And just one last time, thank all our participants, our presenters, and for everyone for joining us. Thank you so much, and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.